From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Tim Wilson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in again for Terry Gross today. What did you do in the war, Daddy? For Americans whose fathers fought in the Second World War, the question was full of pride. But what if you were German? On today's Fresh Air, writer Sabina Reichel talks about the guilt she continues to feel and about ending the silence of an entire generation. Also today, fiddler Johnny Cunningham, a founding member of the Scottish band Silly Wizard, looks back on the Celtic revival he helped launch. Humorist Eileen Segalov looks at the latest wrinkle in baseball cards, Now They Talk. And folk singer Bill Staines brings us two songs in our weekly performance segment. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Sabina Reichel was born German in the generation that came immediately after World War II. When she entered her teens, she began to realize that something had been missing from her childhood. The facts of the Nazi Holocaust were beginning to seep into the public consciousness, and Reichel could see the great gaps in the history she had learned in school. She began to realize the nature of the legacy she had inherited, a horror that few dared to discuss. As an adult, Reichel began raising some difficult questions of her family and her fellow Germans. She's written a new autobiography about confronting her country's Nazi past and her parents' deafening silence about it. The book is titled, What Did You Do in the War, Daddy? Sabina Reichel begins her book with the lines, It still isn't fun to be German. It's a bit like having a genetic disease for which a cure hasn't been found. Reichel now lives in the United States, and I asked her what it's like for her when people find out where she's from.
When I came to America, basically to escape Germany, to escape a father figure, a fatherland, and this terrifying legacy, I wasn't aware of it, that I was escaping that all. So when I came here, I felt pretty good, other than being embarrassed and ashamed, in a way, to be German. And when I met Americans, they never really let me feel that I had a legacy, which the first years being here, I didn't think was so strange, because I thought, sure, I'm innocent, I'm born after the war, and I'm an upright person, so why should they feel that I'm strange or that I'm a German, or why should they think about nationalities? And I have to say, however, that in retrospect, if I think about it, they must have wondered and they must have had their thoughts about me being a German, but they never really asked. Out of politeness, maybe, I think Americans are very polite. They do not dig, they do not ask you really things they would like to know, because it's improper. And so I felt that they were pretty cordial and friendly and silent. Of course, it's different with the Jewish Americans. That was a totally different story.
What was the story there?
First of all, my feelings, my emotions were completely different when I met Jews in America. And as I write in my book, I believe I have never really met Jews before in my life, meaning I grew up really in Germany without any Jews. And if I have, I didn't know, because nobody in Germany introduced himself with, hello, I'm Jewish. And there were very few left. And so when I came to America and met for the first time the people my parents' generation wanted to kill and have killed, it was, and it keeps being devastating in a way. I think there's so much between Germans and Jews. First of all, 6 million dead people, but also, it's a very emotionally charged thing. It's not you cannot rationalize it. It's nothing you can intellectualize or rationalize, because also it had never helped me to say, gee, I'm born after the war, therefore I feel completely innocent and have nothing to do with anything. It does not work.
It never made you feel better or them feel any better?
No, not at all. Because, I mean, I tried when I was a young teenager. I mean, what do you know when you're 16, 15 anyway? But I could never really escape it, and I don't want to anymore. But when I met Jews, they were polite, and I was polite, but I think there were lots and lots of questions that were never, you know, asked, really. I mean, I'm sure Jewish people thought, I wonder what her father did in the war, and how many people he killed. And I thought, probably, well, not probably, I was hoping, oh my God, let this not be a person whose relatives or have perished in gas chambers. So this is what I was thinking, you know. But of course, I didn't say that loud. But when we became friends, of course, this became a topic, and then I was able to talk about that, and so were my friends. But I still feel not very good or happy about that, you know. And it's always an undercurrent, to be sure. And I think it will be all of my life.
Let's start back earlier in your life and just find out what you have been able to find out. Right when and where were you born, and who are your parents? Tell us about them.
I was born in Hamburg in 1946, which is, of course, a classic year. It was peace, but on the other hand, the whole city, you know, Hamburg was completely wiped out. It looked, of course, still like a nightmare or like a movie set disaster. For a disaster film, and so I grew up with lots of ruins, allies, and that was an extremely visually very, very strong way to have grown up. I mean, these are indelible images I will never forget.
Tell me some of them.
One of the most incredible things were really the soldiers who came home. And the cripples, which the grown-ups called them cripples, you know, I guess which...
Unkindly.
Yeah, in a way, it sounds unkind. It's not a nice... I never had a nice connotation with that word. Even though I think the Germans themselves are emotionally crippled, which I think is much worse than, you know, being physically crippled. And so there was this man with one leg and, you know, hopping about on two crutches and a lot of poverty... Disturbed people, pale people with haggard faces. Most of my, when I went to school, most of my schoolmates, profession we had to say in school, were like, their mother was, were widows, you know, when we were asked, so what does your mother do? She's a widow. So I grew up with kids who had widows as mothers, because there's so many people, of course, were killed in the war.
And yet, of course, your mother was not a widow. Your father.
Not at all. No, I am lucky and a little bit maybe on some levels I think unusual even for German, although I think the way I grew up was totally, totally typical in German, and I share that with, I would say, 90% of my generation, because there was also the sameness after the war. There was no variety. That means we didn't have rich or poor, and it was sort of a form of practical socialism, because nobody... Everybody lost, everybody wanted to win again and get something. So I didn't know, like, rich people. So there was no class system. So we were all the same, you know, which was nice, actually.
It sounds, what was the word for it? The Wirtschafts...
Wunder.
Wunder,
yeah,
which is
the
kind
50s,
of
yeah.
Bourgeoisification of Germany, the rebuilding after
right.
the war, where everyone could buy Volkswagens and
right.
kidney-shaped
that's
coffee tables and stuff.
Exactly. This is really the prime time. This is really where I grew up, you know.
So was that an attempt, did you recognize at the time or only just now, to kind of make things cozy and comfortable and paper over all of the pain?
Oh yeah, I'm now totally aware of it. Of course, then no, I was just a young child. But I think my explanation for why Germany is today one of the most powerful nations. I mean, being the industrious people that they are, is also they could never have produced that Wirtschaftswunder if they hadn't repressed completely the senses of guilt, their culpability, and every sense of shame and guilt they put into restoring the facades, and with an incredible speed, of course, as we know. And so the way Germany is today, really, it's thanks to, you know, their guilt, because if they would have taking the time to reflect and to come to terms, to mourn, to feel sorrow, to feel pity, to tell their children for a chance, you know, something. Germany would have been different today, not just look different, it would have been different. And so the irony is, yes, we owe it to the massive repression that Germany looks so nice and clean and was built up that fast.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Sabine Reichel. Her new book is titled, What Did You Do in the War, Daddy? When did this kind of emotional repression, this kind of explosive charge almost buried in the country and in the lives of your own family, start to kind of, I'm mixing a metaphor, but the kind of toxic start to leak? When did it first become evident to you just how much was there under the surface? When did the images of the Holocaust and what had really gone on start to impress themselves on you?
I think as a young teenager, there are... In my family, my father, who I might just mention right now, who was hated the Nazis quite a bit, who was an actor, troop entertainer, who hated the Nazis, who hated uniforms, who never wanted to become a soldier and escaped the draft 3 times and then was sent as a troop entertainer.
He was not a soldier.
He was not a soldier.
He was not active Nazi.
No. To answer your question, what I mean to say is that at home, the subject Nazis was never repressed like it was in many, many, most other homes of my friends.
So you did talk about it as a teenager?
No, the thing is, I really didn't want to talk about it because in spite of what my father did or didn't do or the way how he represented himself had nothing to do with my general mistrust, suspicion, and also my sense of shame to be a German, because a father, Nazi or not, cannot take that away from you, because I am a German and you don't have to have a father who's a Nazi in order to feel the burden of the guilt and to feel the reality also of this country. I mean, the Nazis, it just didn't all go away just as it didn't just start overnight either. So the point is, and I think it's very important because Americans or foreigners don't understand that. They say to me, what's your problem? Your father isn't even a Nazi, so why are you so upset? You don't have to have a Nazi father in order to feel connected to the German past, and it has very little to do. So yes, my father actually liked quite a bit to talk about that at home. But I think when I was like 15, 16, 17, I had also just conflicts because with my father, because the same element that made Germans susceptible to Nazism, it's the same element that made them lousy fathers.
Oh, say more about
that. Yeah. So I think that's one of my recent discoveries. It's the same element, the way they were raised, not showing feelings, having no compassion for other people. So that's a wonderful, grounds for National Socialism. And so that my father didn't choose to become a Nazi, like officially, did not make him really a better father on some levels, I have to say that.
Can you be more specific? There's an episode in your book, for example, when you first bring a boyfriend there with slightly long hair and a pink corduroy jacket or something.
That's the story I think a lot of teenagers then, or young people, had that was typical. Yes, it was, of course, the 60s. We had grown into people who were extremely rebellious. I think the Germans were among the most rebellious and most radical people in the 60s, next to the French and to other European people. And we were, of course, the post-war generation, and we were the most rebellious because we had so much to really rebel against, you know, the whole system, our fathers, our politicians, the still many Nazis around. But anyway, so, of course, I had a boyfriend who had long hair at that time, and my father had the nerve, and I thought it, now I see it a little bit more lightly, but he had the nerve to actually say, I'm not going out with you if this creature comes along, you know, with long hair, to which I, of course, exploded and called him, you Nazi. And I said to him, yeah, we know about this because in the camps, people didn't have any hair, and we should work more, and we know all the stuff you're telling us. Because in Germany, on the streets, I think still it can happen that once in a while an old person says something like, gee, under Adolf, things would have been a little bit differently, which of course is unbelievable. It still happens. It really does.
What did your father do when you accused him of being a Nazi?
He turned pale, shivered a little bit, and was outraged because this was he's very proud, of course, of not having been a Nazi, and therefore I attacked, of course, his most precious, his core. You know, I could have said anything, that he's dumb or ugly or whatever, but this was the worst I could have done. And of course I knew it, because you sense very much what you can hurt your parents most with, and we always knew it was the black spot on their white vests, and this was, of course, the best way of attacking all people around us. And in the 60s, like, saying Nazis to people was, I mean, I did it often, and rightfully so, believe me, because there are plenty around. So I felt quite comfortable yelling and screaming at them, and I was shocked that these people hadn't learned anything. I could not believe it.
I was going to say, was your situation in any way unique? What were your friends going through at the same time? Did you feel that you were able to talk openly about this kind of excavation and discovery and rebellion that you were going through with your friends, or was this something that you were only able to...
Yeah, no, this is a part of the fascinating thing. No, we were not able to talk about that because we had never talked about that. And in spite of how rebellious we were and whether we were standing on the street demonstrating against Vietnam and against this and that, we were unable to discuss our parents because we were raised in this incredible stifling silence, and we had never broken that silence. We were never able to emotionally or whatever. We were so terrified by that past, and we were raised not to ask questions. And we couldn't look at our parents. We could look at the injustice of third worlds and everywhere, but we couldn't look at our own parents.
I'm talking with Sabine Reichel, who was born in Germany a year after the end of World War II. When she grew up, there was a silence about the Nazi Holocaust, and as an adult, she's begun to raise difficult questions, which she's written about in her new book, What Did You Do in the War, Daddy? We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Sabine Reichel. Ms. Reichel, what can you tell me what happened at school and what history classes were like at school? Did you hear the shrieking silence there?
Yes, certainly. Yes, it was the worst because the history lesson in school, there was no history lesson, meaning our teachers, who were, by the way, all participants in the war, because it was that generation, we had pretty old teachers, they managed to come to terms with the Third Reich in 50 minutes, and they rushed through the history books, which had like 15 pages, half a page.
Did you have photographs of
yes,
the
I do remember
concentration
it.
Camps
no,
or anything like that?
No, of course not. We had standard photographs. We always had, for some inexplicable reason, Mussolini, Hitler, and a picture of Stauffenberg, who was the guy who was responsible for the assassination. The teachers were very embarrassed. They did not know what to say about the subject because it was all only like 10, 12, 15 years after the war. So what were these people supposed to say anyway? They didn't know a thing. So there they were in front of a bored class of teenagers, shuffling with their feet and sort of and sweat on upper lips. And so we didn't ask. They expected us not to ask. And so the whole thing was done within 1 hour. And that was that. The next history lesson, we talked about something else. And there was no chance ever to explore this. And it was like some kind of a peace treaty also we made with the teacher. We didn't ask.
You both agreed.
Yeah, we didn't ask, and they didn't talk. So, why would we be different in school? We were raised not to ask questions. So we didn't ask at home, and we didn't ask in school. Plus, the books were terrible, I'm talking here in the 60s, early 60s, like 62, 63, and then suddenly the books by the end of the 60s, early 70s changed radically.
And there was television in the mid-60s too. You talk in your book about seeing a program in 64 when all of a sudden it seemed the veil was lifted somehow. Could you talk about that?
Yes, my father, who was, I must say, quite adamant about almost forcing me to see one of these documentaries that German TV showed very late about what's called the Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And so I saw the Third Reich in its incredible visuality, which was always incredible for me. And I was in a way very fascinating and in a way loved it because it was just to me a teenager who lived in a different world, like with Beatles and rock music. And it was a it was so radically different for me that I just stared always at these images. And
could you believe it?
I shook my head, looked at my father, didn't say anything, but looked at him from the side and thought, they are all nuts. They must have been crazy, because how can they not die laughing having this idiot there with his mustache, this coarse, you know, narcissistic, ugly creep who does nothing but says nothing but utter nonsense. How can it be? And my father kept saying, look, you don't understand that, because it was a different time. So I thought, yeah, I guess so, because I certainly couldn't understand it.
And you do characterize him in that part of your book as being a kid almost. You mean he aroused a mothering instinct in women
so.
In Germany.
I think so. I think he appeared for inexplicable reasons, very seductive, for my grandmother, who was a Nazi. My father, by the way, was the only real heavy-duty anti-Nazi in the whole family, you know. I mean, my mother too, but she's Lithuanian. She hated the Germans and specifically the Nazis. But my grandmother always thought the Führer was the greatest, you know, adorable, wonderful, a heartthrob, you know, and it was always beyond me.
But could you see, and especially now with the kind of psychological insight that you're bringing to bear on your own life and on your parents, how they might have seen Hitler as a father?
Of course. The way the Germans are raised, or those Germans were raised, it was a continuation of the father figure. I mean, they were incapable of seeing through him. If you are raised not to just to obey, and if you're raised not to rely on your emotions and your feelings and your instincts, how are you supposed to later see a man like Hitler, a dictator, and see through him, you know, and identify his problems and be able to see what he's doing? You just react, and the gut reaction of the Germans was, now there we have a man. And so Hitler reduced the Germans again to adolescents and children, and he was Big Papa Adolf, definitely.
I'm speaking with Sabine Reichel. Her new book is titled What Did You Do in the War, Daddy? Can you tell us, what brought this book together? How did you go back and talk with your parents? They're both still alive.
Yes.
Did you sort of do an investigative reportage of your own life that way?
Yes, it was a mixture. The book came about really after having lived in America for like 5-6 years. I suddenly, for the first time in my life, became aware of who I am and where I came from. And for the first time also, I was able to look back. And I think I had to go away from Germany, and I had to leave in order to be able to look at this really devastating legacy and past. So that's when it all started, and I wrote it in English also because I needed a sort of a smokescreen. I still felt it was so painful that I needed some wall in between the subject and myself. So I chose to write it in English also.
Will you write it in German?
Yes, it has been bought. I'm working now on a German translation, which is very, very crazy feeling, because I really did write it in English. Now I have to feel it, I call it. It's not even rewriting it. And in a way, I appreciate that, because it gives me another chance to do the whole thing again in German. So yes, it will come out in Germany.
Did you speak to many people aside from your parents to find out what the past was like?
Yes, of course I did. I traveled around in Germany a bit and talked to old Nazi burghers. And what I found was, of course, horrifying, devastating, upsetting, sad, because except for a few wonderful exceptions, and of course there were some wonderful Germans there too, other than that, these old people were really a horror for me, because they had not just not learned anything, they didn't feel any sorrow or any pity, and
no repentance.
No
either.
Repentance, of course not. And this was the worst. I had thought, okay, when I set out to interview these people, I thought, okay, let's just pretend they didn't do anything. And let's just say, since I wasn't there and cannot really know what they did or didn't do, let me now see how they are now and take it from there. So in the end, I ended up feeling that crime wasn't only in the past, a past I really don't know, but their crime for me is not to feel sorrow or pity. And the way they were sitting there and the way they had cut off their feelings. I mean, the Germans, I always wondered why they didn't suffocate on their repressed feelings and guilt and that lack of mourning. There was this book, The Inability to Mourn, written in the 60s by some great people, the Mitscherlichs. And I felt like, yes, the Germans still can't mourn and hadn't mourned. And I think that's very, very crucial for the process of coming to terms with something. They simply feel no sorrow, no sadness. And so that was devastating, you know. And once a Nazi, always a Nazi. I think that seems to be a breed that never really changed anyway.
So do you think, I mean, this is this could go on for hours or it's gone on for years, this kind of philosophical discussion about can the guilt be transmitted to someone who didn't physically have a hand in it? Does that get, you bear the guilt of your fathers, biblically almost?
Well, I would change...
Is that what you mean?
I would change the guilt, the word guilt into shame. I know I'm not guilty and I didn't do anything and no... We are innocent children, but we are only innocent as long as we don't forget the guilty ones, and that means legacies you cannot change. Meaning we didn't ask for it, we got it. You inherited, and you're stuck with it, and you can make only the best out of it by accepting it. And I found almost a comfort in accepting my legacy because it won't go away anyway. So. By turning a burden into not a blessing, but almost into something positive, is the only way I felt being able to deal with it. And yes, legacies are tough, and Americans have plenty of legacies, but I have to say that they really choose not to deal with it. When I did some lecturing in this country, I had lots of very young people who said to me, look, you're not the only one whose parents didn't talk. There's so many... Vietnam vets, fathers who do not talk to their children. And some of the young people told me that, and they were pretty upset and agitated and told me that. And that gave me a lot to think about. That made me also be aware of that war and pain, basically, is a subject people do not like to talk about. And it doesn't need to be a German in order to suppress war memories or memories of guilt, participation, and shame. So that's a feeling we all have, and it's not only a German feeling.
What do you say to the people, though, who say it's very important to kind of cauterize this wound and that the past is the past and really we have to put that behind, because if you carry that around forever, you'll be crippled emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, forever?
Yeah, of course, it's a total rubbish, and it's dangerous to think that way. Because it simply does not work that way. It doesn't go away by pushing it away and by repressing it and suppressing it. On the contrary, I really do believe that you then have to repeat what you don't learn and what you don't know, and it's a very dangerous attitude. And I've heard that in Germany, and you know, let's stop it. I mean, let's start. It's in the way of gaining a new form of. Confidence, they say in Germany, and especially, you know, the chancellor and all these people say that. But of course, it's dangerous to do that and to say that, because it is with us, and by repressing it, it only pops out in more exaggerated form somewhere else. Probably look at the Republikaner, this right-wing party in Germany.
Sabine Reichel, thank you very much for this. Sabine Reichel's new book, What Did You Do in the War, Daddy?, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm Tim Wilson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be singer-songwriter Carole King. She started off writing songs such as Up on the Roof and One Fine Day. Her album Tapestry was the best-selling record of all time until Michael Jackson's Thriller came along. She has a new album out called City Streets. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Tim Wilson with Fresh Air. I'm sitting in while Terry Gross is on assignment. When fiddler Johnny Cunningham was growing up in Scotland, traditional Celtic music was thought of as quaint and tame. It was also in danger of being lost forever. But Cunningham and his band Silly Wizard have done as much as anyone to spark the Celtic revival that now runs strongly through the American folk culture as well. On today's Fresh Air, Johnny Cunningham talks about preserving traditional music for a modern audience. Also in Fresh Air's weekly performance segment, folk singer Bill Staines plays two songs. And humorist Eileen Segalov wonders about the value of the new gimmick in baseball cards, talkies. Do they come with gum? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Officials say at least two more Chinese diplomats were granted refuge in the United States today, while at least six others defected in Canada. Meanwhile, Chinese officials opened Tiananmen Square to the foreign media for the first time since June 4th. A top military official confirmed that the 27th Army and other units launched the main assault against pro-democracy protesters. It was the first time journalists were allowed on the square since the massacre nearly 2 weeks ago. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
It was the first official news conference today conducted by the Army. A Chinese general contradicted himself when asked about the night of June 4th. He said that some troops were blocked outside the city by what he called people who did not know the truth. Chinese leaders maintain that counter-revolutionaries attacked the Army in an attempt to overthrow the government. In Tiananmen Square, the general said that troops had directed their fire into the square when what he called thugs provoked soldiers. But then he said that soldiers didn't shoot people in the area of Beijing. The contradiction was not explained. Foreign eyewitnesses say they saw soldiers shoot demonstrators in the early morning of June 4th after Chinese tanks had moved onto the square. Chinese and foreign sources say that many unarmed civilians were killed in the alleyways around Tiananmen Square as troops trapped and shot fleeing demonstrators. In Beijing, this is Deborah Amos.
Poland's prime minister today blamed the Communist Party's defeat in recent elections on underestimating the strength of the opposition campaign. In the June 4th vote, candidates backed by the Solidarity Movement handily beat government candidates. Prime Minister Mieczysław Rakowski says Poles' dissatisfaction with the government and living conditions have made them judge the party one-sidedly and pin their hopes on Solidarity. He said party supporters must adopt a fighting spirit. A second round of voting is set for Sunday. Former Hungarian Prime Minister Imre Nagy, executed after the 1956 anti-Soviet uprising, was reburied today in Budapest. Hundreds of thousands of mourners attended the ceremony, seen as an important political step for Hungary's future. The BBC's Misha Glenny has details.
A dignified silence reigned over the new cemetery in Budapest as six coffins were lowered slowly into the ground. Imre Nagy was accompanied back to the grave, which has been unmarked for 31 years, with the four other victims of a secret trial held in 1958. The sixth coffin represented the unknown revolutionary. Before the reburial, over 300 names of those executed after the 1956 revolution were read out. The reburial followed a remarkable display of public mourning when hundreds of thousands turned out in Budapest's Heroes Square to honour the dead. This public rehabilitation of the leaders of the 1956 revolution is of great political significance. The way has now been cleared for the creation of a multi-party system in Hungary, which has undergone rapid political change over the past few months.
Misha Glenny in Budapest. A private escrow agent who diverted millions of dollars from government housing programs said today she considers her illegal actions a sin. Marilyn Harrell repeated claims to the House Subcommittee on Housing that she donated much of the money to charitable projects to provide housing for the poor. Harrell, also known as Robin Hood, said she intends to repay the government. Consumer prices took a big jump last month. The Labor Department reported a 0.6% rise in the Consumer Price Index in May. The increase was driven by energy prices, which rose more than 1.5%. For the year, consumer prices have risen at a seasonally adjusted rate of 6.7%. That's up from more than 2% from last year. In a separate report, the Commerce Department said new housing construction fell just over 2% in May. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 11 points to close at 24.86.38. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Folk singer and songwriter Bill Staines joins us today in our weekly performance spot. For nearly 20 years, Staines has been traveling the country from Boston to Alaska, playing and singing about cowboys and horses, ramblers, lovers, and friends.
This is a story about a fellow by the name of Old Penn. Well, Old Penn was a friend of mine. He used to sit down by the square. He was kind of a local monument. You know you'd always find him there. He never caused anybody any trouble, town folks just passing by. Sometimes you'd hear him laughing to himself. Sometimes you'd see him crying. Well, us kids, we used to go to him and we'd listen to his songs. Well, some of them were happy. Some were just plain long. He used to pick them out on this old guitar that he'd won once when he'd been out at sea. And I can still remember all the words that Old Penn spoke to me. He said, son, well, listen to me. Don't you go telling no lies. Just get you in deep trouble. They just follow you like flies. He said, son, watch where you're walking. And don't be afraid to lose. Put some memories in your traveling bag and miles upon your shoes. Put some memories in your traveling bag and miles upon your shoes. Well, it's the miles that'll teach you about the people and the differences in their ways. But don't you walk so fast on down the road, you forget to feel the summer days. Don't walk too fast, yet don't walk too slow, and don't ever forget your name. Never laugh at a man when you see him down, boy, if you may someday have to play his game. He said, son, well, listen to me. Don't you go telling no lies. Just get you in deep trouble. They just follow you like flies. He said, son, watch where you're walking and don't be afraid to lose. Put some memories in your traveling bag and miles upon your shoes. Put some memories in your traveling bag and miles upon your shoes. Well, Old Penn's place is empty now. I guess he's long gone to his reward. But I can still recall the songs that he sang and I even know the chords. So as I sit here by this roadside on my way to where I choose, I've got his memory in my traveling bag and I've got miles and miles on my shoes. I've got his memory in my traveling bag and miles on my shoes. He said, son, well, listen to me. Don't you go telling no lies. Just get you in deep trouble. They just follow you like flies. He said, son, watch where you're walking. Don't be afraid to lose. Put some memories in your traveling bag and miles upon your shoes. Put some memories in your traveling bag and miles upon your shoes. It seems as if I spend a lot of time out on the road and I get to meet a lot of people and go a lot of places. And it's nice to try and get to know the people and how they feel about their homes and about their families and work. And I try and write about those subjects. And that tends to make the songs a little more universal, I think, and more people can identify with them. This is another sort of a road song called Moving It Down the Line. When you're moving it down the line, you've got to travel a lot or leave a lot behind. You're just breezing through, buddy, buddy, just breezing through. You run a lot of roads, you see a lot of towns. Some will get you up and some will bring you down. But you see it all when you're moving it down the line. When you're moving it down the line, you meet a friend or two, you leave a friend behind. Well, that's the way it goes, buddy, buddy, that's the way it goes. Looking for the music up over the hill, feeling like you're nothing but standing still. Well, that's the way of things when you're moving it down the line. You got a one-armed bandit up on your back, This is drop another year and I'll pay it back. But those old 777s never ever seem to come your way. Then from the second floor window of an old hotel, you hear the early morning traffic in the village bell. And you find yourself singing like a sparrow at the break of day. Got a one-arm bandit up on your back. This is drop another year and I'll pay you back. Oh, those old 777s never ever seem to come your way. Then from the second floor window of an old hotel, you hear the early morning traffic in the village bell. And you find yourself singing like a sparrow at the break of day. When you're moving it down the line, you gotta travel a lot or leave a lot behind. You're just breezing through, buddy, buddy's breezing through. You run a lot of roads, you see a lot of towns. Some will get you up, some will bring you down. But you see it all when you're moving it down the line. Mm-hmm. You see it all when you're moving it down the line. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you feel it all.
Bill Staines. You can find a compilation of his songs called Bill Staines' The First Million Miles on the Rounder record label. This is Fresh Air. I've always loved Celtic music, the traditional music of Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and Brittany, but I'd sort of tuned it out in recent years. Then I ran into a piece by our own Ed Ward in Mother Jones magazine, not known for its traditionalism, so I figured it was time to catch up on my Celtic. One of the guys Ed said to listen to was Scottish fiddler Johnny Cunningham. Here he is in one of his early incarnations with his group Silly Wizard. When we put music like that on around here, there's not very much Scots blood, I have to say, in the people here. But it doesn't matter. Everyone starts to tap their feet and sort of tap the loose change in our pockets. Do you have to be Scots to appreciate this? Why is it that it connects with so many different ranges of people?
Well, I think Celtic music seems to move all types of people. I don't think there's any one particular musical background. That people tend to come from to listen to this kind of thing. Once they hear it, people tend to be drawn to it, I think, basically because I think it's very old and there's a depth to the music that maybe newer music doesn't have, so it connects with a lot of people.
Now, when people hear you, could they, like Professor Doolittle, or at least with Eliza Doolittle and Professor Higgins, say, aha, he's from that part of Edinburgh?
I don't think so, not at all. I think I have a fairly mongrel style, basically, because I grew up with both Scottish and Irish music, and I kind of have a synthesis of various styles. A lot of things have affected my playing. Even like Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, stuff that I listened to when I was growing up that wouldn't specifically be Celtic music, but just moved me in some way, crept in.
Do you hear stuff in this country? You mentioned the Texas Playboys. Do you hear stuff in this country when you hear country and old-time fiddlers that you could identify as being from Scotland, from your roots?
Yeah, tons of stuff. It's great. I think the fiddle's an amazing instrument, and America is a great place to be if you're a fiddle player, because it's such a melting pot of cultures, and each culture seems to have its fiddle tradition, so you can get the best of all that music here in one country.
Let's listen to a bit of your fiddle playing then. Do you want to say something about what we're going to hear?
Sure. This is a tune called Leaving Brittany, and it was written on the ferry coming away from Brittany after a tour there. And it's a kind of tune that's part Breton and part me, basically.
Great, let's hear a bit. Johnny Cunningham playing fiddle on a tune called Leaving Brittany, and the Pernod Waltz, is it?
The Pernod Waltz, yeah.
And what's a good Scot like you who should be drinking scotch, drinking Pernod?
Well, you know, when in Paris do as the Parisians do, I don't know.
Now let's move also away from the fiddle. You really committed in some ears, I guess, eyes, an ultimate heresy when Celtic went electric and the bagpipes... met the synthesizer and the sequencer. How is that marriage working out?
Well, I think if you respect the tradition, then it has to work out. To tell you the truth, in Scotland and Ireland, people are much more open-minded about this kind of thing than the people we call the ethnic police, who are people who really wish they were from places that they're not, and they hold on to folk music as something sacred and unmoving, rather like a museum piece that has no life. They tend to think of it as having one place in time. There was nothing before and there will be nothing after.
And I'm a lover of this music, I have to confess, but there is something, there's a hardness to it, there's a kind of edge to it, there's almost a sort of violence to it sometimes. I'm not talking about the slow airs. I've been in parts of Scotland and you find kids that just have nothing to do. This music kind of expresses a lot of their frustration in ways, is that?
I think you're exactly right. I think that it's music that very much reflects the cultures that it come from. It's a working class music. It's music which documents the feelings of people who maybe don't have that much to look forward to. They tend to drown themselves in the music, you know. And I think you're right. There's a lot of there's a lot of energy to the music. I think sometimes, yes, it could be construed as being violent.
Yeah, not that it should have to be feel-good music, but that there may be more protest and relevance in it than people give it credit for.
Oh, I think any part of someone's culture that has a definite relevance. I think we lost or were in danger of losing a lot of our own culture because of the encroachment of other cultures. And it took a long time for this music to be a cool thing for a kid to want to have. You know, they used to take my fiddle off me and break it on a regular basis, and I was slightly put upon by other people when I was at school. I used to come home bruised and broken, having been told by even the teachers at the school that what I was playing was gutter music, the way that I spoke was gutter language, because they had a lot of teachers there who didn't understand the difference between what was good Scots and what was bad English.
They were English teachers, wanted to speak properly.
Yeah. Well, properly to their standards, you know. So I think when we first started, there was a lot of people saying, look, these are these really young people that dress and look the same as us, and they're playing, what's this music they're playing? And all of a sudden, the younger people in Scotland and Ireland started to discover that this was their music. We had audiences back home where there would be kids coming in there, you know, like 10, 11, right up through, like, you know, punked out kids, and then right up to people in their 80s and 90s. The BBC actually did a documentary on the Highlands and Islands, and they talked to some woman, I believe, on Islay, who was over 100 years old and spoke very little English. In fact, this was for Radio Highland. And they asked her if there was anything that she hadn't done in her life yet that she would still like to do. And she said, if I got married again, I'd love to have Silly Wizard play at my wedding. You know, it's kind of really a cool thing, you know.
Did you go play for her anyway?
Oh, God, I would have loved to, you know.
Now, what you were doing until 3 o'clock this morning was working on a rock album, I gather.
That's right. I play with a band now called the Rain Dogs. So this is my first foray really into the cold world of rock and roll.
How does it feel?
It's very exciting, but it's very different from anything that I've ever done before. I don't think I really ever have worked as hard as I have since I started playing rock music.
Johnny Cunningham, will you go back home to Edinburgh, or is it fair to call that home?
Oh, yeah, I think the States is home for me just now because I love the excitement of the working environment. And what I hope to do is I'd like to, not sounding normal, you know, Scottish modelling, which is normal, but I'd like to go back to Scotland to live out my years, I think. I think working over here has has an edge to it. It seems very unsafe. If you don't look after yourself, no one else will. Whereas back in Scotland, I think a lot of what I wanted to say musically, I would never have bothered to try and do because people looked after me there, you know? And I think sometimes, that even though that's a great thing, it's not the way to constantly produce what you want to produce.
You seem to have taken pretty good care of yourself here.
And you know, there's a lot of great people here too, you know?
Thanks, Johnny.
Thank you, Tim.
Fiddler Johnny Cunningham. And if you want a good time, recordings of his groups Silly Wizard and Relativity are available from Green Linnet Records of New Canaan, Connecticut. This is fresh air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Tim. About China tonight, the leadership there is attempting to sell their version of what happened the night of the massacre in Tiananmen Square. And we'll talk with Ross Terrell of Harvard University, who's in Beijing, about the mingling of Chinese culture and Leninist doctrine that may indeed work in the government's favor in this case. Also an expert about Uzbekistan explains that the marauding Uzbeks aren't really in an ethnic fight against the Musketeans there. We'll talk with Tess Gallagher, the widow of Raymond Carver. His new book of poetry is out now. It's called A New Path to the Waterfall. It's a book of poetry written during the last year of his life.
Thanks, Noah. These stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Baseball cards are almost as old as baseball. First they came in cigarette packages, then starting in the 50s they came with gum. But commentator Eileen Segalov says the card is still evolving.
Hello, I'm Don Drysdale.
And I'm Joe Torre. Welcome to the world of baseball talk.
The other night at a family dinner, I mentioned a new kind of toy I'd heard about, talking baseball cards. I thought I'd finally found a subject my 14-year-old nephew could get excited about.
Yeah, the talking cards, they have an appeal to some people, I guess, not me. I don't think these are an investment. Maybe in 20 years it'll be worth a little more than it is now, but I can't really see potential in this in the long run.
Oh, well, you see, my nephew's been collecting baseball cards since he was 6. And growing up in the 80s, he's the first to admit he loves the cards and the money they're worth. His bedroom walls are decorated with limited edition baseball lithographs, rare counterfeit rookie cards, and personally autographed glossies. My nephew's no lightweight. The problem is, he's so serious. I decided it was time to loosen him up, so I whipped out my newly purchased sports talk player. It's an orange and blue plastic box resembling a cassette machine, but you slip in colorful plastic talking cards. I popped in a shiny Hank Aaron card and turned up the sound.
Here's the pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is gonna be... The fireworks are going. Henry Aaron is coming around third. His teammates are at home plate. And listen to this crowd.
My nephew grinned, then quickly put on his business face.
I think they're kind of a put-on, kind of like a gimmick, and it's a way for this company to make money. That's all I think.
Who could think about money at a time like this? Goosebumps ran up and down my spine as I settled into 1974 and the magic of the moment. I was just about to play Oral Hershiser when my brother-in-law mentioned a recent stock merger. All ears turned to more sensible things, and I downed my dessert and disappeared. I've always loved baseball and bubble gum. I was the only person I knew who would actually chew the gum that came with the cards. I loved cracking open a new pack, sticking the gum in my mouth, and looking for my favorite L.A. Dodgers. I collected Gil Hodges because he had bedroom eyes, and Wally Moon because I liked how his eyebrows grew together. I carried the cards with me everywhere, and after a few years, they were frayed, worn, and loved. It never occurred to me that one day they'd be valuable. I shared this bit of personal history with my nephew. He said,
I think anybody who bends their cards or defaces them has got to be crazy, because they're just kind of throwing away money.
I felt kind of foolish. I guess I've just got to accept my nephew and I are from different worlds. At 14, it never occurred to me that my Barbie dolls or clutch purse collection could be traded in for a car or a college education. Of course, I still wish I had my Sandy Koufax card and my Mickey Mantle. I'd be in the money. Instead, I'm in love with a new toy that may never be worth more than its face value, but gives me the feeling I'm touching the heart of a game I truly love. And my nephew has lightened up a bit. He confessed he might have made a mistake or two in his investment strategy when he started out.
I started collecting cards with their wrappers because I thought, well, maybe the wrapper will be worth something someday. So I started collecting the gum, too. I don't know, I thought maybe someday someone will come by and...
Someone would buy your gum from 1976? Knowing my nephew, he's probably right.
Eileen Segalov is a writer, artist, and along with her nephew, a diehard Dodgers fan. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross speaks with composer Carmine Coppola. Throughout the 40s and 50s, he was a flutist with Arturo Toscanini's NBC Symphony Orchestra and in Broadway musicals. But then he turned to composing and won an Oscar for his score to Godfather II, a film directed by his son, Francis. On the next Fresh Air, Carmine Coppola talks about his score to the silent movie epic Napoleon. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest album by trumpeter Don Cherry. And television critic David Bianculli previews the 500th anniversary special of Siskel and Ebert. Their weekly show has made them the best-known film critics. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Tim Wilson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.